Hi everyone, and welcome to this new episode of Guida Galattica per Fisioterapisti interview. Today with us we have Shane Kelly. Hi Shane.
Hi there, how are you? Hey Paolo.
Yeah, good, thanks. So today with Shane we're going to discuss different topics, and we're going to talk about his experience with working in athletics. But Shane, as we normally do during our interviews, if you can introduce yourself to our community. So if you can tell us a little bit more about your background, your education, and obviously your professional experiences.
Sure. All right. Thanks a lot, Paolo. And thanks for having me along today to the podcast. We're really, really happy to have a bit of a chat with you. I suppose you mentioned the fact that I worked in athletics, and I did work in athletics for many years, but sort of my current role as it stands today is, I'm the clinical director of the Royal Ballet. So I am a physiotherapist by trade, but I suppose in this new clinical director role, I've now moved more into management. There is still a little bit of clinical and applied work that I do as part of my role, but more management and oversight. My current role is clinical director, as I said, and I'm really responsible for the management and oversight of a elite healthcare service within a ballet and dance context. So we have a full multidisciplinary team at the Royal Ballet, which I'm now responsible for. And so I line manage not just physiotherapists, but S&C coaches, nutritionists, psychologists, ballet coaches, just to name a few of the services we sort of run at the Royal Ballet. And really what we're trying to do there is replicate a lot of the setups that exist in elite sport these days, with full multidisciplinary teams on site almost every day for the dancers to be able to support them as in their pursuit, in their artistic pursuits. But really, if you've had any experience with dance, you'll know that dancers are athletes in themselves, and the things that they have to do are extremely athletic. And yeah, it's a real privilege to be able to work with these sorts of athletes now, these sort of dance specific athletes. But I've only really been in that role for the past few months, and as you mentioned, athletics probably is where I cut my teeth as a therapist. I only left British Athletics, my role with British Athletics, in August of this year, of 2020. And before that, I'd worked in elite level athletics for 15 years. So initially, I'm Australian, if you can tell from my accent still. And I grew up in Australia, did all my education and training in Australia, and worked in Australia for about 5 years as a physio before moving to the UK. But in that time in Australia, I was working with some Australian athletes and with Athletics Australia as a contractor. And really, that's where I got my start in sport. And after doing, like I say, four years working in private practice, working in athletics in Australia, I had a year at the AIS, the Australian Institute of Sport, which was a great year where I learned loads. And off the back of that, then I moved to the UK and worked for 10 years for British Athletics. And within that, over the last 5 years, I was the head physio, head physical therapist for British Athletics. So really, that's where I probably have most expertise still at the moment, with athletics and athletic related injury and running, particularly running related injury. And I still find it really, really interesting and still have a clinical interest in that regard. You asked about my education and training. My education, as I said, I trained in Australia. I went to La Trobe University in Australia, which, has a really great reputation internationally, and more they're really churning out some high quality research and have some great practitioners and clinicians and academics based there. And so I was lucky enough to go to La Trobe University when I was an undergrad and did my Bachelor of Physiotherapy there. After I graduated in 2004, I had a few years off postgrad study. Then I did my sports masters. I got my sports masters by 2010, I'd achieved that. And then I had another break again from postgrad study. And then more recently in 2018, I got my business and management diploma. So, I took a step away from doing sort of sports science, health science related studies. And I did something completely different. And I did business and management. And I really enjoyed that. I really enjoyed the topic, the materials. So I picked up some new skills. And it just taught me to think in a different way and really I wanted to do that to push myself to think outside the box, to think a little bit differently from a physio, and take some of those skills and ways of thinking into a health context. And I really think that's helped me in my roles as both head physio and now clinical director with the Royal Ballet. So, yeah. So what am I now? I'm 16 years post-grad, 16, 17 years post-grad. And I'm happy with where I'm at the moment.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, very, very interesting. Yeah, very interesting. The postgrad in business as well. Yeah, very, yeah, obviously very, very broad, but different, definitely for physio.
Yeah, I think just I did it mainly to, lead. They do a lot on leadership and working in teams and elite environments and people management. And really, that's what I wanted to get better at, because, you yourself, Paolo, work in an elite team, and you realized how important team dynamics can be in elite sports environment. And I wanted to bring some business thinking into that.
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And so that's, obviously based on your long experience in athletics, the first question is definitely on injuries in athletics. So what are the most frequent injuries in the athletic world?
Yeah. So if you just look at the literature, actually, there isn't loads on injuries in athletics in the elite population. There's lots on, I say, college athletes. There's some on sub-elite level and amateur athletes. But in the elite population, a lot of the studies have been in a competition environment only. So there's been lots of studies looking at injuries in a competition environment. And in this environment, in this context, things like World Champs and Olympic Games, they seem to find that the most common injuries are still soft tissue injuries, so muscle injuries. And that's come across again and again. And one big study looking at, I think, 13 World Championships over a number of years found that, muscle injury was the most common injury in track and field. To take that a bit further, the actual, the sort of region that we're honing in on, it's not just muscle injuries. It's really in a specific region. And they talk about more thigh muscle injuries being the biggest area, the body area that's injured. And as you can imagine, probably the most common injury within the thigh muscle compartment is going to be your hamstring injury. Mm-hmm. And certainly, within my time with British Athletics, we kept our own injury statistics, and by far and away the most common injury, specific injury that is, within track and field, is the hamstring injury. By a long way, it's really, really common compared to something else, say like your Achilles tendinopathy, which was your second most common injury in athletics or an elite cohort. But, it wasn't anywhere near as common as, say, the hamstring. And then thirdly, again, looking at our elite cohort and the work we did at British Athletics, the most common thing was a calf muscle strain, actually, particularly soleus injury. So, if you look at the mechanics of running, the exposure, the requirements of elite level track and field, it's not surprising that the hamstring, the Achilles, and the calf are the most common things injured in that sport. So that's about it, really. They're the ones you really need to focus on if you're dealing with track and field athletes and elite level running athletes. Yeah.
So over your time in athletics, were you covering like all the specialties, or were you more specialized in some of them?
Yeah, within the British Athletics program, when you're a therapist working on the program, the elite level program within the United Kingdom, if you're working for the federation, as it's called, you would normally work across all events. So yeah, sprinters, middle distance runners, throwers, even at times. Although it has to be said that within the whole British Athletics program, the most common athlete on the program were sprinting and running athletes. So we had a big emphasis on the track, a big emphasis on relays. And, over around 40 to 50% of those athletes on the program were sprinting athletes. Okay. So, that's who, as practitioners, we were exposed to most. very rarely I'd see a thrower, very rarely I'd see a marathon runner, but you know, it could happen.
And then the next question will be more about injury prevention.
Yep.
So what are the key factors to monitoring those athletes? But at the same time, the question would be obviously in within the framework of their training schedule, where would you fit the injury prevention?
Wow. So this was a big one. This was a big one and you know, an ongoing piece of work within track and field, and what's still going, you know, since I've left, I'm sure, is, you know, how do we tackle injury prevention in athletics, particularly across so many different events and event groups? But if we just focus on running and running based athletes, so your sprinters and your middle distance runners, you know, what are the sort of things that what are the lessons we can learn from those running based athletes that could be applied in other sports as well? You know, with, you know, whether it's field sports that require a lot of running. And it's, I just want to say that we haven't cracked it and it's not perfect. And, you know, everything you do has to be specific to your context. So for us, what we did, you know, the biggest thing I sort of learned working in track and field is the individualization of injury prevention programs. It's not a one size fits all thing for all athletes. So if you're talking about injury prevention, you don't just give everyone Nordics and say, yeah, we've done injury prevention. No, you've got to look at the athlete that's in front of you. You've got to look at whatever their weaknesses, their deficiencies, or whatever you want to call it, that you have to address that will decrease their risk of getting injured. One of the most effective ways of identifying risk factors for soft tissue injury, of which there are many and they're complex, is to do some sort of screening, you know, at the start of a season. You know, that's got to be an integrated part of what a team or what a coaching group does. It's like at the start of a season, you've got to get some baseline measures of injury that are known to relate to injury risk. And then once you've got those baseline measures, you try and track a few of those through the season. You monitor them, as you're saying, so to see whether your training programs are having the desired effect, to see whether these risk factors are heading in the right direction. And therefore you are able, as the practitioner, you are able to influence these things in a timely way. I think the biggest thing, the most important thing, is to try and get both a screening program implemented and a monitoring program implemented. You have to have buy-in from the coach and the coaching staff, and you have to have buy-in from the conditioning staff, i.e. S&C coaches or otherwise, or physiologists. And as that elite performance team, you all have to understand the value of doing those things. I think it's really hard as a physio or as a different sort of therapist working in an elite sports environment to implement screening and monitoring if the coach and the conditioning staff don't believe in it. Mm-hmm. And it's almost got to be as important as the training itself to the coach and to the conditioning staff. If it is that important to them, it'll happen, and actually meaningful things will happen, and you will have a genuine chance of influencing injury risk within your program. So that's probably the summary, is that identify the things that contribute to risk in your sport, screen for them at the start of the season, and monitor them throughout the season. And hopefully you're working in a really cohesive and collaborative team where you'll be able to influence those things as you need to throughout the season. And then at the end, you review everything. Hopefully your injury stats are looking good. And then you try and refine things again and do it again and better the next year. And just build on the process year on year, refine the process. And that's really what we did in athletics. And we had good results, particularly in reducing our hamstring injuries. But like I said, it's still an ongoing piece of work to try and get those down.
Yeah, definitely. And I was thinking about the difference, because obviously in football you play every week and sometimes you play twice a week as well, and it's really hard to then fit your monitoring and your injury prevention. But obviously I'm guessing in athletics, where you have maybe a few months of only training between events, then you got a lot more time to schedule better your injury prevention.
Yeah. You do in theory, but again, I've had different experiences of you've got all the time in the world, but still the monitoring doesn't happen for difference, and mainly because of buy-in and coach doesn't believe in it or something like that. But then the flip side, I've seen a really busy team environment, elite level football, Premier League football, where monitoring is part of what they do, and it can happen. And they walk in on a Monday morning and they do 15 minutes of monitoring and tests in the clinic and filling out stuff on an iPad, and then they go off and do their training. It's just part of what they do. And if you can get it to that sort of level, then you're golden.
So then you mentioned some of the injuries, and you obviously mentioned calf injuries in track and field. So my next question will be particularly on calf. So if you have, for example, an example of someone who's coming to you with calf pain, whether he's a professional athlete or recreational athlete, how would you carry an assessment?
Yeah, I mean, calf pain... pain is such a broad thing. It could be almost anything if someone's presenting with pain. And I really think you should, anyone that presents to you in a clinic, you know, just because they're telling you they think it's a calf strain, keep an open mind, you know, keep your mind open and just listen to them more and give yourself the opportunity to ask questions and be really trying to get really specific about the diagnosis you're making. But, you know, if someone's complaining of calf pain and they're really pointing to the musculature of the calf, so the gastrocnemius or the soleus, you know, it's going to be a high probability that you're talking about a muscle strain. There aren't many other things it could be. You know, there are some small differential diagnoses things, but if someone's pointing to their calf, they're using their one finger and they're going, this is the spot and it's pain. And they talk about a mechanism of injury that's just really indicative of a calf strain, then you know that's probably what you're dealing with. So if someone's coming to me with calf pain, I've asked the question, I've tried to establish a really clear mechanism. If it sounds like a calf strain, then I'll go, you know, reasonably quickly into my objective assessment. And the biggest things, the key things to look at in an objective assessment, if you're suspecting a muscle injury, pain on stretch, pain on palpation, and pain on contraction. And if they've got all three signs, then you're almost certainly dealing with a muscle pull. And that could be for a hamstring or a calf or a quad. But yeah, pain on stretch, pain on contraction, and pain on palpation. Those three things, almost certainly a muscle strain. And I would treat... and I would treat it as a muscle strain from there on in. Some other things that might help, you know, confirm your diagnosis even further is, like I say, the sort of finger point test. If they're really specific and they point on a certain part of their calf, you know, really localized muscle pain, well, then again, that's another thing to add to say, well, you know, that's quite a localized muscular issue. That's probably going to be even more another chance of something to add weight to a muscle injury. And then, as I said, you know, from the subjective, they've talked about a mechanism of injury, you know, i.e. running at speed, and they felt a pull or a pop or a tear or a cramp, any of those sorts of things, I would be really, five things by that stage, really suspicious of a muscle strain. I suppose the last thing, you know, for me coming from British Athletics, we were always really keen to scan, even for the most minor muscle strains. I think radiology is important at elite level, and we wouldn't hesitate sending someone off for an MRI, whether it was for a hamstring or a calf. And, you know, you've got your clinical suspicion, you've got your five things that really make you think it's a muscle strain, but what you want to try and get from the scan is to confirm that that's actually true, but also, you know, to I really specifically identify certain structures are involved or not. So yeah, I would always back up a muscle strain if I suspect it with a scan, if that's an option for you.
Is there anything more functional that you would advise, like to test in a clinic setting, for example?
Yeah, I mean, it depends how much depends how much pain they're in. But if it got to a functional assessment, I would just start on various different ways of loading the calf functionally, and progressively increase the challenge on the calf muscle. So, you know, very, very simply, I'd start, you know, if they're always has to be within pain limits, and always has to be within what they're comfortable doing as a patient. And so I'd ask the question, what sort of pain are you getting out of 10? And are you comfortable doing it? And if they're more than a 2 out of 10 pain, or if they're not confident in doing it, then you just don't do the test. But at every stage, I'd ask that question and move on. So, you know, if it was a calf strain, as we're talking about, I'd probably start with a double leg heel raise or double leg calf raise off, you know, standing next to the bed, using the bed for support with their hands. If they can go up to on two toes, no problem. Then I'd take one of those away and I'd just do a single leg calf raise. Great. If they could go through the single leg calf raise, no problem. Then I'd go for a really small hop on the spot. If they get through a really small hop on the spot, fine. Then I might take a really small hop forward. And if by that stage they can hop forward, you know, small hops forward fairly comfortably with no pain at all, I'd almost be going, well, actually, maybe this isn't a strain at all. Maybe it was just a cramp. But nonetheless, if you want to go through, take it even further, then I'd progress those hops to bigger hops. And if they get through something where they're forward hopping with minimal pain, then, you're probably not dealing with a true calf strain, or it's something else entirely. But that would be my sort of functional progressions, from obviously more deloaded static work to more functional dynamic work.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks. And just to finish off, we finish off with a big topic at the moment, which is return to running, which is obviously useful for athletics, but with many other sports as well. Can you give us like three must-do tests or criteria that you would use for return to running? Especially thinking that a lot of our followers don't work in elite sports, so something that they can use and take home and use in their clinics as well.
Yeah, look, no, that's absolutely fine, Paolo. I think the biggest thing that you need to be really confident with, if we're still talking about a calf strain, so an injury to muscle tissue, you want to have those three cardinal signs clear before starting to run. So I talked about pain on stretch, pain on palpation, pain on contraction. So if on the bed, they've still got a bit of pain, or any of those three signs, I wouldn't be saying, you know, you can start jogging today, you know, or I'd be really, really hesitant of that, and certainly not running fast. So before any of my patients sort of start anything really dynamic, I'd want to be almost completely clear on all three of those signs. So yeah, no pain on stretch, no pain on contraction, no pain on palpation. So once they've got those things clear, which sometimes might take 3 days, it might take 5 days, it might take 10 days. But once they're clear, then you might consider starting your return to running thing. So when I'm talking about return to running, I'm talking about something, you know, at least a jog or a return to a jog or a stride type program. So the other thing that I'd really want to test, you know, before, particularly before even a jog or a stride, is those three signs are clear. That's done. If you're confident in that, then get them hopping, and I'd get them hopping in the clinic. And again, if they can't hop up and down on the spot in the clinic, or if they can't hop forward in the clinic, you know, start with little hops and then go with bigger hops. But again, they have to be pain-free, they have to be awareness-free, and they've got to be confident to do it. So if you've got a patient in the clinic and they don't want to hop because they're scared of hopping, because they think they might pull their calf again, then they're not ready. And you need to do something else to either develop the strength qualities in the calf or develop their confidence again to start running. So that would be my second thing, is confidence to hop in the clinic has to be an indication that they're confident to run out in the field. So that would be my number two. You know, again, three clinical signs clear. That's the first one. Second thing is they got to be able to hop in the clinic. Now, let's say that they've done those two things. They've hopped in the clinic, then you've taken them out for a run. You've taken them out to the pitch. You've got them run a few times, do a few jogs, do a few strides. They've got through that fine. Great. I think that the last one to sort of give them a full sign off before a, you know, return to sport, is you'd want to test them at high speed at some point. you know, you've taken them through their progressive running program, but to be fully confident that they're ready to compete, you probably want to put them through some sort of test at the end, a high level test. And for that, you know, hopefully, again, you don't need lots of technology for this. You can use a stopwatch and some cones, but you know, I would do something like a flying 30 sprint or a start 0 to 20 meter start acceleration test, field test, to sort of give a final sign off of high speed running. So yeah, at the start, there was two tests to establish whether they can run at all. And then the third test would be a high end test right at the end of their progressive running program to establish that they're, you know, one, can run fast, and two, you know, are taking a step towards returning to compete again, you know, return to play sort of measure right at the end for high speed, I think is required. So they're three low tech tests that I would say would have to be part of a progressive running program, return to running program. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks. That's really useful for people who normally see recreational runners in their clinics almost every day. And then just another thing, if you are fortunate enough to have those screening, as you said before, and monitoring in place, in that case, where do you want your athlete to be able to return to running?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. If you've done a robust screening process at the start of the season, there might be some clinical markers that they've baseline markers that they have that you want to get them back to. So certainly in athletics, we did a single raise heel test calf capacity at the start of a season. And, you know, every athlete, you know, would have got a baseline to their calf raise test. So they're one of the markers that I'd want to hit in a return to running program, probably before they start running, you know, before they even start jogging. You want to make sure that their calf capacity is back. You know, you might be lucky enough to work in a club which has access to force plates, and whether it's the physio staff or whether it's the performance conditioning staff, you might have some baseline measures for that athlete regarding force plate measures, you know, things like repeated hop test or a drop jump or a counter movement jump, and all the metrics regarding those, depending on your sport, depending on athlete, whatever. You might have some baseline force plate measures that you want the athlete to hit before they start running. And again, in athletics, we had those sorts of markers, force plate markers, and the S&C staff were the ones mainly responsible for ensuring that athletes had the strength qualities required to get back and return to running. And we would monitor those through a return to running program as well. So that is a very handy bit of kit if you got it, but yeah, Realize it's very expensive and not accessible to everyone. But, you know, there are cheaper alternatives out there which can give you some objective measures, such things like jump mats and some of the apps out there these days are not bad at giving you some basic metrics for dynamic strength qualities. The last thing I think that's most important, like it's going to guarantee your success with a return to running program, though, is really, really listening to your athlete and working with your athlete and with the coach. You know, the athlete knows their body the best. The coach knows running probably the best. And if you can have a great relationship with your coach and your athlete, you know, with them pitch side while they're doing their rehab running at whatever level, and you're looking, you're listening, you're talking to the athlete, you're talking to the coach, you're looking at their mechanics. And then at the end of the session, you're monitoring how they recover and you're clinically assessing them, how they recover. And then you're making the decision to take the next step the next day. Then that's really going to round off that whole return to running process. You know, return to running is not just a set. There isn't one test that's going to say you're ready to run. And even a series of objective markers along the way isn't going to say that you're ready to run or take the next progression. To round that off, you've got to be monitoring how the athlete's responding within session and post session and the next day. And then it's a shared decision to progress with the coach and athlete that will really, you know, give you the most well-rounded sort of return to running program, and also the highest chance of success with return to running. If you're not, if you're just taking objective tests and spitting them back to the coach and saying, crack on, I think your chance of a recurrence is going to be a lot higher than if you're actually working with the athlete and working with the coach and involving them in the process and agreeing to progress together. And you've got really, you know, the athlete's confident to do it, the coach is confident to do it, and you as the therapist is confident to do it. I think that's when you really get the most bang for your buck with a return to running program, but also reduce the risk of recurrence the most. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Don't rush it. Yeah. And the other thing is, don't rush it. If your gut is saying feels too soon, it probably is. And just listen to your gut a bit. You know, listen to the athlete and listen to your gut. And I know there's pressures. You know, there are different pressures in different environments. But if you're in an environment where there's no pressure, and you can take your time, then take it. You know, there's no medals for getting back the quickest. And I tell you, there is bullets for those who have the recurrences.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I totally agree. A lot of good take home messages. Like, definitely take your time. Talk to your athlete. Absolutely, 100%. Just the last thing before we end the interview, Shane. Mm. If some of our colleagues would like to ask you something or get in contact with you, what's the best way to do so, or what's the best way to follow you on social media as well?
I think the best way is just through. I've only got one sort of social media platform, and that I use, and that's Twitter. And I'm on it fairly regularly. So if people want to contact me, they can direct message me through Twitter. I've got open access to my direct messages. So just send me a message on Twitter if they've got any questions or want to contact me. I'm quite happy for people to contact me, and always happy to meet more therapists, more people working in sport or dance, and just, always looking to push myself and learn and meet interesting, like-minded people as well. That's what it's all about.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Shane. Thanks for today.
Paolo, thanks for your time, mate. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, and thanks everyone for being with us today, and we hope to see you soon for the next episode of Guida Galactica for Physiotherapist Interviews. See you soon. Mm-hmm.